I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Today I thought we'd talk a little bit about Syria. We've talked a bit around it and about it over the last couple of times, but haven't addressed it directly. Jim, what is the current situation in Syria as far as ISIL and I guess we've got several different things going there. We've got ISIL and we've got Assad being propped up by the Russians and the resistance to that. What is the current state of things?
Well, everybody's going after ISIL. ISIL has no friends. ISIL is also having money problems. A lot of people don't realize that running a country, they have a lot of expenses. Even though they stole over $500 million worth of cash, a lot of it foreign currency, when they took Mosul 18 months ago, they have a fairly substantial payroll. In addition to other expenses, the payroll is enormous because a lot of the people, most of the people working for ISIL in Iraq and Syria are on the payroll. And that costs over $5 million a month. Indeed, some of the defectors, as it were, that intelligence people in Turkey, Iraq, and Jordan have interviewed. America gets access to those, that information. Have reported that one reason they left, well, there were two reasons. The main reason was they hadn't been paid in the last few months, which indicates a cash flow problem. The other reason they left is because in the last few weeks, especially since the Russians intervened, but it's worse now. When the Russians came in, they didn't use the old American rules of engagement. And that has been leaking into the news. It leaked, for example, that 75% of the aircraft going out, the armed aircraft going out on missions, returned with their weapons because they couldn't get permission to release because it was determined there was too great a chance, or any chance in some cases, depending upon who you listen to, that a civilian might get hurt. And, of course, the ISIL was deliberately exploiting that by using human shields, often quite blatantly. In one example, which they of course, put a video on the net, they had enemies, I think they were non-Muslims, they were Shia, right. Shia they had captured, and metal cages. And they would roll them around in trucks in, so they could be easily recognizable. Whenever they had a target they wanted to protect from getting bombed, at least by the Americans, they would have one of these trucks standing there. And of course, they broadcast a video with the poor people inside those metal cages saying, "Please don't bomb us." That worked with the Americans, but it didn't work with the Russians. So suddenly, the ISIL is suffering, substantial personnel and, more to the point, financial losses because the Russians are bombing sites that were previously immune. Now, the French got involved after November 13th because of the Paris attack, which ISIL took credit for. And the French, unlike the Russians, had access to the American targeting data. Now, the one thing we're very good at is finding targets. Well, we have a lot of problems with is getting permission to hit them. The French aren't using our rules of engagement. It's a popular thing in France at the moment not to use our rules of engagement. And we are hitting all the targets that the American pilots haven't been able to hit. And for some strange reason, the American government hasn't intervened, or we haven't heard about it yet, to try and keep the French from that information because it's getting civilians killed. But the main objective, as far as most of the people fighting ISIL, is to shut down ISIL. And now, with this, this recent massacre out in California, there might be a loosening of the American rules of engagement. American Air Force people were told that a loosening of the rules of engagement was in the works. I have not, a lot of this stuff is classified, and I don't want to step on anybody's, security. Apparently, it hasn't been looked at yet. And so the American pilots are still restricted, but are targeting people, reconnaissance, you know, people and what have you. They're still, you know, allowed to wail on. And so they're furiously finding targets and passing them out to the French and anybody else who's willing to send bombers in after ISIL. And if ISIL, you know, basically loses their get out of bombing free card by using civilians, naturally this, and this happened before. In Afghanistan, it was a big scandal because this whole tightened rules of engagement began in 2009, and there were a lot of complaints from Afghan civilians. You know, they said, look, we understand we're at risk, but damn it, kill these people, because they're going to kill us eventually if your bombs don't. And we're more, we feel safer getting bombed by Americans than shot at by Taliban. And this is a similar attitude like the Kurds have been complaining about the rules of engagement. Now, what the Kurds were able to do, you know, when they're using American air support, they carefully shoo away all civilians. And the ISIL hasn't reached a point yet where they can drive some unarmed civilians in front of their troops for an attack, because the Kurds will just shoot the civilians. So the ISIL get out of bombing free card has limitations, which the Kurds exploited, and that's why we like to use the Kurds, because the Kurds basically kill ISIL. But we can't use those Kurdish tactics deep inside of ISIL territory, where the ISIL has plenty of civilians. By the way, the civilians are not stupid, obviously. Let's you know, feel for the civilians. They are fleeing ISIL-controlled territory. I mean, Raqqa, the capital city of eastern, you know, Syria, is basically a ghost town compared to, you know, before they took it over over a year ago. Mosul is also losing a lot of its population, to the extent that for, I think, most of this year, ISIL has been setting roadblocks to keep people in Mosul, because so many of them are trying to get out. Partly that because they can't keep the economy going if they haven't got people there, and partly because they don't want to lose the protection. If the only people left inside are ISIL, you know, we're going to level the city. Now, the Iraqis are protesting that, but at this point, even the Iraqis are saying, you know, bomb them wherever you find them, you know, and we'll sort out the damage later. So that's what's happening right now. ISIL is still a player, but they're obviously suffering losses, and they're on everybody's hit list.
Austin?
Well, I think Jim's analysis of the rules of engagement issue vis-a-vis the United States is dead on accurate, unfortunately. Just for some background on that, Dan, remember human shields and the Desert Storm, and then again in 2003, even though Saddam didn't get as much out of them, where sometimes volunteers from the West, you know, your standard issue useful idiots would show up and chain themselves to anticipated targets, such as electrical generators or industrial targets, even some headquarters. I remember one building where a couple of these people from the West had shown up, and they were going to stand between American bombs and defend the site with their lives. Well, that's one type of human shield. That's again, I said that's the useful idiot type, but it plays into an American reluctance to inflict unnecessary casualties or incidental casualties. I mean, they still occur when a 2,000-pound JDAM lands in a neighborhood. What Jim described is outright hostage taking, and where you're taking entire neighborhoods hostage. Also, mosques, churches, hospitals, whatever. Think of those as structural hostages, which is what they amount to. ISIL has pushed it too far. Paris did that with the French. With the Russians, of course, it never mattered. Interesting that Jim brought up San Bernardino. It's not clear how that's going to play, but certainly the U.S., the executive branch, the White House is kind of now caught between its restrictive ROE, and I look at the links that it's still not clear whether it's directly ISIL connected, but it certainly has the suggestions. I'm going to talk about San Bernardino, but the global kind of threat that ISIL presents. I think Jim's right in bringing up bringing attention to the fact that ISIL has been degraded. This is where some of this slow operation has had effects. This isn't news. I wrote a column about this, Dan. I think it was very early this year, 2015. That may have been late last year because it was the Battle of Kobani had concluded. I'd have to go check. But Kobani, which was a Syrian Kurd town right on the Turkey-Syria border, was a major defeat for ISIL. And they had been getting a steady increase up to that time. Now, I'm basing this on about four or five different sources that were estimating the number of recruits that ISIL was attracting. But up until the time of Kobani and the Kobani defeat, it was increasing or holding steady, and they were getting some substantial recruits from Europe, elsewhere in the world, including some from North America. Well, they lost. The lowest figure I've seen there is 2,000. I've seen a figure of 3,000 fighters in that battle. And since then, the recruitment started to fall off, and some of the other losses that they have had, they're just not getting the recruits, at least into the Iraq-Syria caliphate. As Jim pointed out, they're trying to hold on to the civilians they control now for hostage purposes, but also running the country. But also, they're saying that they've got people living there, is it gives them a semblance of being a government of a real state, and that was what appealed to the recruits. So they are being degraded, at least in the Iraq-Syria area. If we look, and I know we're focusing on Syria here, but just for ISIL, there have been some very good reports over the last 2-3 weeks on ISIL's activities in elsewhere. Libya primarily, but Egyptian Sinai, Yemen. I know we've been writing about this on the strategy page, but it's real. They do have what they're calling provinces now of the caliphate, and they're having something that's an echo of their initial success in Iraq and Syria. They show up, and there's still people to rob, Dan. There's still hostages to hold. Now, I think I'd add one other thing, because when you began, you said, well, there are all kinds of groups there, and you know, we got an overlay of really four or five. Depends on how far you want to go. Syria was described in the late 1970s as a big Lebanon. This was as the Lebanese Civil War was going on. Well, it's all part of the Greater Levant, which is one reason the Islamic State started as we still refer to it as ISIL, Islamic State in the Levant. And the mountains of Lebanon and, they continue on into western Syria and some of the remote areas in eastern Syria and the desert. And some of the enclaves along what is now the Syria-Turkish border were places that small ethnic groups, religious sects that didn't quite fit in with other religious sects, remnant populations and the like gathered. And Damascus has been a major urban area for really thousands of years. It's been a cosmopolitan place compared to other other places throughout. I guess it's want to say the rest of the world. In some ways, at one time, it was of course competitive with Byzantium, Constantinople, and the like. And what we're left with is a super pizza pie. If Bosnia was a pizza pie, Dan. Sectarian and ethnic divisions, Greater Syria, which is one way that the Syrians look at it, including Lebanon, is the same kind of ethnic and sectarian pizza pie. And we hear about the Syrian Kurdish militias. I think YDP is their one of the abbreviations for them. They're that's aligned sometimes with the Kurdish Kurdistan Workers Party in Turkey, the secessionist group of Turkish Kurds. Well, they're really, as far as I can tell, at least two other small sub-Syrian Kurdish militias. They may at times be aligned with YDP. They may really just reflect what the inclinations of their local village. It's tough to get clarity on this. It'd be interesting if we had access to the intelligence agencies' resources on it, but even those might not be clear because, again, it gets very, 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 very granular. And this is part of the problem of putting together a quote-unquote Free Syrian Army or a reliable resistance that can take on Assad and also turn on al-Nusra Front and ISIL. And the Syrians are aware of it. They're very aware of it. They're also aware that this is one reason that the control apparatus of ISIL, that these folks in these small places don't like them. They don't like them at all. They hate them. They're just another oppressor. And they thought at one time they're going to get rid of Assad. There's another oppressor. So I think that's useful, at least in understanding why it's so fragmented. It has to do with 4,000 years of history and the human traces of that 4,000 years of history.
Jim, let's talk for a minute about the shoot down of the Russian jet by Turkey along the Syrian border.
Well, that was part of a centuries-old feud. The Russians and the Turks have been battling each other for literally, hundreds of years. The Turks were hostile to the Russian presence as soon as the Russians showed up. And, of course, some of the people, the rebel units that the Russians were going after in defense of the Assads were operating along the border. And they purposely, now I don't know if this was being done on purpose, but they would be so close to the border that in order for the Russians to come in and bomb them, they basically had to risk going across the border. Now, this happened several times. The Turks basically were very, how should I put it, angry. And they let the Russians know it. The Russians apologized a couple of times, said, hey, we're not doing it on purpose, et cetera, et cetera. But apparently, now this is partially domestic politics in Turkey. This dislike of the Turks is a nationwide. They're very popular, people to hate are the Russians. It's a bloody history. And the Turks, Turks should win sometimes. The Russians, unfortunately, won most of the time. The Russian objective always was Constantinople and access to warm water. They always talked about that. But the Turks were ferocious fighters, so there was never any love lost between the Turks and the Russians. So for whatever reason and under whatever circumstances, the Russian aircraft, came close enough for the Turks and they shot it down. Now, the Turks are in trouble here. Now, the Russians don't want war with Turkey. They know about, NATO, when was it, Clause 5, that you can invoke if you're attacked by, a hostile alien power. But the Turks have economic problems. Now, Russia is a major trading partner, but also they're a major supplier of natural gas and petroleum, especially the natural gas. And Russia has been known to use the embargo of energy supplies to try and coerce somebody into doing their will. And one reason the Russians haven't actually done that yet, they're threatening, is because they know the history between them and the Turks, and they know that Turkish domestic opinion would become extremely angry and ask and demanding that the government do something. Now, in most countries, but especially in Turkey, When the people say do something, it means call out the army and go to war with the SOBs. The Russians do not want that. I mean, they do not feel that they couldn't, as they have done in the past, at least fight the Turks to a standstill. But the Russian army is less than a fifth of what it was at the end of the Cold War. The Turkish army has not gone down that far. In fact, the Turkish army is arguably larger and more powerful than the Russian army is right now. And the Russians love doing the correlation of forces drill. That's a whole other story. But anyway, they know that they would have a hard time going to war with Turkey. Now, Turkey would suffer enormous financial damage. They probably would have a hard time getting NATO to fulfill their obligations, although they might. Russia right now is not on everybody's, favorites list. But it's not a slam dunk for the Russians. They have a problem they do not want. They could have just stayed away from the border, but they didn't. I mean, that's partly Russian macho. Vladimir Putin is the Russian strongman that the Russians are so fond of. And that's what's gotten them and the Turks into so much trouble in the past.
Austin?
Well, I wrote a column on this last week, Dan, I think within the last 2 weeks. And because the shootdown occurred November 24th, didn't it? I think that's
yeah.
It. Yes, yeah. And then I wrote it the week after that. I agree substantially with what Jim said. I think there are a couple of other things that people ought to consider to when they get the full picture on this. One is that Jim brought up Russian macho. Well, since this precedes the Crimean invasion and annexation, the increase in Russian probes of NATO airspace and NATO, let's say, leaning airspace. I mean, there's Sweden and Finland, because some of the best documented are in the Nordic region of air and sea probes, and including the one that I've written about. I've mentioned twice in columns the probe in June 2014. Of course, this is after Crimea, of Bornholm Island, which is a Danish island in the Balkans. And the script for that probe was right out of Russian Cold War macho and provocation. But they've also increased probes of North American airspace, U.S. and Canadian, and even adventures into deeper into the Pacific. I noticed there was a report of a Russian aircraft again probing Guamian airspace. I'm not sure where they took off from. They may have taken off from Vietnam for all I know. Just speculation. That was a headline. But the fact is the big story there is that they are doing it. Now, that part of it doing it is because Putin, bewails the loss of the USSR, and he wants to, display bravado and say we're tough and a global power. The reaction is that we're tired of it. It's gone on repeatedly. They're brittle. As Jim said, the Russians are weak. And here's Turkey's chance to show Putin, you are weak. And Erdogan has got a similar personality to him. Now, Dan, and Jim knows this for sure, I am not a fan of Tayyip Recep Erdogan. But the guy's a bully, like Putin. But he's given Putin some pushback. And from what I gathered, and this is responsible reporting. Heck, this comes from the NATO Council. Beginning in late October of this fall, the Turks were telling NATO, look at this violation, reporting what the Russians were doing, saying that this is where the Western intelligence started, and it started showing up in the news media. Russians are targeting anti-Assad rebels, not anti-ISIL rebels. In other words, they're doing the dirty work for the Assad dictatorship. And we had a strategy talk, Dan, where I said one of the things that Putin was up to was showing that it paid to be his ally or Russia's ally. We'll stand with you, is what he was telling dictators. Well, he was doing that. That's what the aircraft were doing, carrying it out missions to support Assad's dictatorship. And in the case of the shootdown, This, excuse me, a moment ago I talked about all these little, you know, ethnic groups and sectarian groups. Turkmen are, or Turkoman are ethnic Turks. Doesn't mean that they were in what we now think of as Turkey, but they were spread out in various places throughout the Ottoman Empire. You'll still find Turkmen groups in Central Asia, you know, Turkmenistan and the like. But here's a little example of a Turkoman, small Turkoman region that is near the Turkish border within Syria. And so there's the same thing when Putin plays the Russian ethnic card. It doesn't matter who's in Ankara. There's the Turks have said, you know, repeat, this is before the World War One, Ottoman Empire. This is one of their groups that they whoever's in charge in Turkey, it protects. They're our ethnic kin. And they pointed this out to the Ankara pointed this out to the NATO Council, and then the Friday before it happened, and a source on this included a pretty good Wall Street Journal article on it. Again, I'm guessing they sourced it both to Turkey and NATO. The Turkish Foreign Ministry called in the Russian ambassador. One story said deputy ambassador, but we're senior Russian Foreign Ministry official in Ankara, and said, "You better stop it or else." And then they proceeded to provide the or else. As Jim said, that plays very well in Turkey, especially when the enemies are Russian. And that's when I go back to now that, you know, Jim's analysis about why Turkey feels, okay, yeah, we're vulnerable. Everything Jim said about the economics is real. I will say that there have been some changes that perceptible, at least in the big town, Istanbul. I'm not sure what the figures are. I read one that said last year over 2 million Russians visited Istanbul. They like to go there. It's Constantinople. And the Turks like to have them because they spend money. And so that's gonna hurt the tourist business. But it also, those are the kind of things that, you know, the level of animosity may not be what it was in 1871 between these two nations. So it would hurt Russia very much if they got into a shooting match with the Turks. And I think Turkey would invoke NATO Article 5. I don't know if it would, they'd have the cause as they had with the aircraft actually entering airspace, if it escalated now. That's, things get a little arguable here diplomatically. You know, you have to get a treaty expert. But then again, the thing is Article 5 doesn't totally commit you. It doesn't commit you to military action, but it commits to alliance action, and the Turks would expect military support. But so Putin's got to think about that. Messing with Turkey's not messing with Ukraine, Dan, and he's aware of it. He has escalated rhetorically. You know, he's accused Erdogan of profiting personally from selling, you know, illegal oil sales. I thought that was some macho agitprop. And Erdogan popped back at him and says, "If you can prove it, I'll resign. But if you can't prove it, you resign." You see, that's the kind of punchback that Putin doesn't get from anybody.
Right. Well, let's wrap it up there, guys, for this week. And we'll be covering, I guess we're going to be coming up on our end of the year broadcast here, where we'll do a review probably next time. So our listeners can look forward to that. And hopefully they'll all follow closely our reporting as the year wraps up here on Strategy Page. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.